I have to admit, when I first looked at the file names for this week's deep dive, things like Central Venous Access Device Care and Pediatric CVAD Guidelines, I really thought we were in for a dry one.
Yeah, those titles don't exactly scream exciting.
No, not at all. I mean, on the surface, we are basically talking about medical plumbing.
It is plumbing, technically, but it's plumbing where the pipes are inside a human being.
Right.
And the fluid is life-sustaining medication, and a single bubble of air or a speck of dirt can be catastrophic.
Exactly. And that's what hit me once I actually started reading the Island Health policy docs and the nursing skills manuals we're using today. We aren't just talking about tubes, we're talking about lifelines.
Lifelines. Yeah, that's exactly the word the sources use.
Because these devices are the only reason modern medicine can do things like aggressive chemotherapy or long-term nutrition without destroying a patient's body in the process.
That's the trade-off. To treat the disease, we often have to use therapies that are incredibly harsh.
Harsh on the veins.
Right. The peripheral veins, the ones in your hands or your arms that you'd use for a standard blood draw, they just can't take that kind of punishment.
So the mission for this deep dive is to unpack the hidden science of these lines. And I was surprised by how much physics and biology is involved in just keeping them running.
Oh, absolutely.
We've got fluid dynamics, we've got bacterial fortresses, and we've got a really counterintuitive rule about syringe sizes that I still can't quite wrap my head around.
We will definitely get there. It's one of those things where your intuition is actually dangerous.
But let's start with the geography. The sources keep referring to central access. Geologically speaking, where is central in the human body?
It's a very specific destination. No
Right.
matter where you insert these devices, whether it's in the arm, the neck, or the chest, the tip of the tube is always aiming for the superior vena cava, the SVC.
The superhighway of the circulatory system.
Exactly. It's the massive vein returning blood from the upper body to the heart. Specifically, we're aiming for the cavo atrial
The
junction.
cavo atrial junction.
It sounds complex, but it's really just the exact point where the SVC meets the right atrium of the heart.
But why there? Why is that specific real estate so valuable compared to, say, the vein in my elbow?
It comes down to volume and flow rate. The blood flow in the SVC is roughly 2,000 milliliters per minute.
Wow, 2 liters a minute.
Yeah, in a hand vein, it's a trickle by comparison.
And this matters because of dilution, right? I saw some pretty specific, scary numbers in the Cobbett PDF regarding the chemistry of the drugs.
Right, the safety limits.
Yeah, it mentioned osmolarity greater than 900 millisieverts per liter and a pH less than 5 or greater than 9.
Those are the safety limits for a normal vein. If you put a drug that's highly acidic, like vancomycin, or has a super high osmolarity,
Which basically means it's very thick and concentrated.
exactly, like total parenteral nutrition, TPN. If you put that into a small vein, it burns.
Like literally burns.
Chemically burns. It strips the lining of the vein. It causes inflammation, clotting, and eventually the vein just collapses. We call it chemical phlebitis. But if you dump that same caustic liquid into the rushing river of the SVC, it's diluted instantly. The vessel walls are completely protected.
So the CVAD is basically a hardened tunnel to get the dangerous stuff safely into the deep ocean where it can't do damage near the shore.
That is a very good way to visualize it.
Okay, so we know the destination, but the sources describe a few different vehicles to get there. I think most people tuning in have probably heard of a PICC line, but the hardware tour in these documents was pretty expensive.
The PICC is definitely the most common, peripherally inserted central catheter. It enters in the arm, usually the basilic or brachial vein, but the catheter itself is long.
It goes all the way up.
It threads all the way up your arm, turns the corner at the shoulder, and drops right down into the chest.
And the advantage there is that you don't need surgery to put it in.
Correct. A specialized nurse can place it at the bedside using ultrasound. It's relatively low trauma for the patient, and it can last for weeks or even months.
But then you have the tunneled catheters, like the Hickman or Broviac lines. The description of these in the text had a detail that felt straight out of a sci-fi novel, the Dacron cuff.
Oh, I love the Dacron Tuff. It's such a smart piece of bioengineering.
So how does it work?
Well, these lines are surgically placed for long-term use. The tube enters the vein in the neck, but it doesn't come out of the skin there. Instead, the surgeon tunnels the tube under the skin so it exits lower down on the chest.
And the cuff is hidden inside that tunnel.
Right. It's a small band of synthetic mesh on the catheter, positioned just under the skin. Over a couple of weeks, the patient's body actually heals into the mesh.
Wait, the skin grows into the plastic.
Granulation tissue grows directly into the fibers, yeah.
So the body physically grabs onto it.
It anchors it so you can't accidentally pull the line out. But more importantly, it creates a biological firewall.
Against infections.
Exactly. Bacteria from the outside world love to crawl down the surface of catheters. The cuff creates a seal of living tissue that bacteria just can't cross.
That is incredibly cool. It uses the body's own scarring process as a security system.
It really is. And then for the lowest profile option, you have the IVVAD or implanted port.
These are the ones completely under the skin, right? Like a little bump on the chest.
Yes, a titanium or plastic drum sutured into a pocket under the skin. To access it, you have to stick a needle through the skin and into the port. But the documents are very aggressive about this rule. You absolutely cannot use a regular needle.
Yeah, the non-coring or Huber needle rule. Why does the shape of the needle matter so much?
Imagine the top of the port is a self-sealing silicone mat. If you use a standard hypodermic needle, which has a slanted cutting edge like a shark tooth, you're basically using a cookie cutter.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Every time you poke it, you core out a tiny cylinder of silicone.
And eventually, the port leaks.
The silicone turns into Swiss cheese, and now you have chemotherapy drugs leaking into the patient's chest tissue instead of the vein.
That sounds disastrous.
It is. A non-coring needle is designed to slice through the silicone and spread it apart rather than cutting it. When you pull the needle out, the silicone just snaps back together.
So if you just grab the wrong needle from the supply closet because you're in a rush, you've ruined a surgically implanted device.
Exactly. It's a detail that seems small, but the consequences are huge.
There was one more distinction in the hardware that seemed really critical in the Island Health documents. The difference between valved and non-valved lines. The text makes it sound like if you treat one like the other, you're in trouble.
This is probably the most common point of confusion for people managing these lines at home. A non-valved catheter is basically an open straw. If the end is in your heart and the other end is open to the air, blood can back up into the tube.
And if blood sits in the tube, it clots.
Right. So for non-valved lines, you have to be religious about using an external clamp on the tubing whenever you aren't using it. And you usually finish with a heparin lock.
Heparin is the drug that stops clotting, right?
Exactly. But the valved ones like the Grosschong,
Yeah, what's the deal with those?
they have a piece of technology built right into the tip inside the body. It's a pressure-sensitive valve. It stays closed by default.
So you don't need clamps?
No clamps. If you push fluid in, the pressure opens the valve outward. If you suck blood out, the vacuum opens it inward. But the moment you stop doing either, it snaps shut. It's a built-in safety gate.
Which means if you accidentally clamp a Grosschong, you could actually damage the tube because it's not designed to be crushed like that.
Precisely. You really have to know what you're dealing with.
Okay, so we've got the hardware installed. Now let's talk about keeping these things running. The source material spends a huge amount of time on flushing.
It really does.
And I'll be honest, before this, I thought flushing just meant squirt some saline in to clear the pipe. But apparently, there's a whole physics to it.
There is. It's all about fluid dynamics. If you just push the plunger of the syringe steadily, what we call laminar flow, the fluid travels down the center of the tube very nicely.
Sounds good so far.
But the fluid touching the walls of the catheter moves much slower because of friction.
So the middle gets clean, but the walls stay dirty.
Exactly. You leave a layer of residue medicine, lipids, blood stuck to the walls. It's like rinsing a dirty plate by just letting the tap run over it gently. The stuck-on food just stays there.
So the guidelines call for the push-pause technique.
Right. Push stop. Push stop. This creates turbulence. You are creating little eddies and swirls inside the tube that physically scour the walls.
It's the difference between a gentle stream and a dishwasher spray arm.
That's it, exactly. You need that mechanical turbulence to prevent buildup.
Now, here is where we get to the part that genuinely confused me at first, the syringe size rule. I saw this warning in bold in the Island Health text. Never use a syringe smaller than 10 milliliters to flush a central line.
This is the classic physics aha moment for new nurses.
It feels backwards. My intuition says a small syringe has less liquid, so it must be gentler. A big syringe looks like a water cannon. But the sources say the small syringe is the dangerous one.
It's all about PSI, pounds per square inch. Pressure equals force divided by area.
Okay, walk us through that.
When you push on a plunger, your thumb is applying force. The area is the surface area of the plunger head inside the barrel.
Got it.
In a 10 milliliter syringe, the barrel is wide. The force is spread over a large area, so the pressure coming out of the tip is moderate, maybe 15 or 20 psi.
Which the catheter can handle.
Easily. But now take a 3-milliliter syringe. The barrel is skinny. That same force from your thumb is concentrated onto a tiny surface area. The pressure skyrockets.
Oh, wow.
You can easily generate 50 or 60 psi with a small syringe.
And the catheter.
Most are rated to burst around 25 to 40 psi. So if you use a 3-milliliter syringe to try and clear a blockage, you aren't cleaning the line. You are essentially turning it into a pipe bomb.
A pipe bomb in a vein.
You can rupture the catheter right inside the patient's body.
That is a terrifying image. You're trying to help, and you blow a hole in the lifeline just because you picked the wrong piece of plastic.
That's why you'll see nurses taking a tiny vial of medication and transferring it into a big 10-milliliter syringe before injecting it. It's not about the volume of fluid, it's about the physics of the barrel.
So we've got turbulent flow and pressure dynamics. But even if you do everything right, there are enemies. The sources list a few complications, but three really stood out to me as the big bosses of CVAD care: occlusion, infection, and migration. Let's start with occlusion.
The blockage. This can be mechanical, like a kink, but usually it's biological. It's the thrombus, the clot.
The sources describe something called a fibrin tail. I tried to visualize this. Is it like a clog?
It's more like a flap. The body knows the catheter is a foreign object, so it tries to coat it with fibrin, which is a clotting protein. Sometimes this forms a tail that hangs off the tip of the catheter.
And it acts like a one-way valve.
Exactly. When you push fluid in, the pressure pushes the tail out of the way. The line seems totally fine. But when you try to pull blood out for a sample, the suction pulls that tail back over the opening. It seals it shut.
So you can infuse, but you can't aspirate.
We call it withdrawal occlusion. It's often the first sign that a clot is building up, and this links right to Virchow's triad.
I had that written down here. It sounds like a secret society. The Virchow triad.
It really does. But it's actually just the three conditions that lead to clotting. One, vessel wall injury. Two, alteration in blood flow. And three, hypercoagulability.
And a central line causes all three.
It's the perfect storm. The catheter scratches the vein wall that's the injury. The tube takes up space in the vein, slowing down the blood flow. That's the flow alteration.
And the third one?
Usually the patient is sick with cancer or sepsis, so their blood is naturally stickier. That's hypercoagulability.
So you are fighting a constant uphill battle against clotting.
Always. Every single day.
Enemy number two is infection. The stats here were sobering. One source said 85% of bacteria causing catheter infections come from the patient's own skin.
Yeah, we often blame dirty hospitals, but in this case, the enemy is already on us. The bacteria on the neck or the chest migrate down the insertion tract. And once they touch the plastic, they do something very clever. They build a biofilm.
The slime matrix.
It sounds gross, and it is. The bacteria secrete a sugary, sticky substance that covers them. It anchors them to the catheter and acts like a shield.
A shield against what?
Everything. Antibiotics can't penetrate the slime. White blood cells can't get to the bacteria. Once a biofilm is established, it's almost impossible to clear. You usually just have to pull the whole line out.
Which brings us to the scrub, the hub rule. The guidelines are completely obsessive about this. You have to scrub the connector for 15 seconds.
And let it dry.
Right, the drying. I feel like that's the part that gets skipped when people are in a rush. Why is the drying so important?
Because the friction of scrubbing breaks up the biofilm, but the antiseptic, usually chlorhexidine, needs to dry to actually destroy the cell walls of the bacteria. If you connect the line while it's still wet, you are just washing live bacteria and chemical antiseptic directly into the patient's bloodstream.
So 15 seconds of scrubbing plus drying time is the only thing standing between the patient and sepsis.
It's the most critical 30 seconds in the whole process.
Okay, the third enemy, migration.
Yeah.
The line moves. The Island Health document listed a symptom of this that I found absolutely wild. The swishing sound.
Oh, this is a classic tell. If a patient says to you, hey, when you flush my line, I hear a gurgling or whooshing sound in my ear, you need to stop immediately.
Because the line has gone up instead of down.
Exactly. The tip of the catheter has flipped out of the SVC and gone up into the internal jugular vein. It's sitting right next to the structures of the ear.
Wow.
So they're literally hearing the turbulence of the saline rushing into their jugular.
That is visceral. And that's why measuring the external length is so important.
Yeah.
Every single shift. You measure how much catheter is sticking out of the arm. If it was 4 centimeters yesterday and it's 9 centimeters today, the tip is pulled back 5 centimeters. It's not where it's supposed to be.
And for kids, the margin for error is even smaller.
Much smaller. A child's chest cavity is tiny. A movement of just 1 centimeter is significant.
Really? Just 1 centimeter?
If it moves 1 centimeter, you might need an x-ray to confirm it hasn't poked into the heart wall or slipped out of the safe zone.
Speaking of poking into the heart, let's talk about the emergency protocols. There was a section on air embolism. This is the risk of air getting sucked into the vein and blocking the circulation.
This is a life-threatening emergency, and it happens because of pressure gradients. When you take a deep breath, your chest creates a vacuum to pull air into your lungs.
Right.
But if you have an open central line, say, during a dressing change or removal, that vacuum will suck air right into the vein.
So how do you stop the vacuum? The text mentions the Valsalva maneuver.
You have to reverse the pressure. You ask the patient to bear down like they are having a bowel movement, or you tell them to hum loudly.
Humming.
Humming creates positive pressure in the chest. It turns the chest from a vacuum into a pressurized vessel. So instead of sucking air in, it pushes out. It creates an airlock.
That is such a low-tech solution to a high-tech problem. Please hum so you don't die.
It works. But if air does get in, you have to act fast. The protocol is to place the patient in the Trendelenburg position on the left side.
I know Trendelenburg means head down, feet up, but why specifically the left side?
This is pure mechanics. You are trying to trap the air bubble. Based on the anatomy of the heart, if you lie on your left side with your head down, the apex of the right ventricle becomes the highest point in the heart.
And since air rises.
The bubble floats up into that corner of the ventricle and gets trapped there. It keeps the bubble away from the pulmonary artery, which is the exit.
That is fascinating.
You are essentially hiding the bubble in a corner of the heart until it can be absorbed or aspirated so it doesn't shoot into the lungs and kill the patient.
Wow. You are using gravity to manipulate a bubble inside a beating heart.
It's a desperate move, but it saves lives.
There is one more rule that was repeated in almost every document, usually in all caps, the no scissors rule.
I wish this wasn't such a common horror story.
It seems obvious, don't cut the patient. But it's about the dressing, right?
It is. The dressing is really sticky. It's so tempting to use scissors to snip the tape to get it started. But these catheters are soft silicone or polyurethane. They slice like butter.
And if you cut the line?
Here is the nightmare scenario. If the line is under a bit of tension and you snip it, the internal piece can snap back. It disappears into the puncture site and floats away into the bloodstream.
So now you have a loose piece of plastic floating toward the heart.
Exactly. It becomes an embolus. That's why the care in the community section suggests patients carry a specific tool, the Kelly clamp.
The clamp without teeth.
Right. If the line breaks or gets cut, you have to clamp it immediately between the break and the patient. It's the emergency break. Every patient with a CVA should know exactly where that clamp is.
Before we wrap up, we touched on kids earlier, but is there anything else specific to the pediatric guidelines that really stood out?
Aside from the size issues, it's the fragility. The catheters used for infants are incredibly small, 3 French or 4 French.
Tiny.
The guidelines warn specifically about twisting. If you twist the line while you are trying to tape it down, you can actually tear the lumen or kink it permanently.
And I imagine the activity level is a huge factor. You can't exactly tell a 2-year-old, please sit still and protect your sterile field.
Not at all. Securement is everything in pediatrics. If a toddler yanks that line, it's a surgical emergency.
So looking at all of this, we've gone from the anatomy of the SVC to the physics of 10-milliliter syringes to the biology of biofilms and the mechanics of trapping air bubbles.
It really covers the whole spectrum of science.
What really sticks with me is how much of this high-tech medical care comes down to very low-tech discipline.
That's the takeaway for me, too. We tend to focus on the installation, the surgery, the x-rays, but the patient's safety really happens in the mundane.
Yeah.
It happens in the 15 seconds of scrubbing a piece of plastic. It happens in the choice of a syringe size. It happens in remembering to ask a patient to hum.
It's the triumph of protocol over entropy.
Nicely put. And you know, it raises a question for everyone listening, whether you work in healthcare or not. We often chase the big flashy solutions. But how many failures in medicine and engineering or just in our daily work are actually just failures of basic maintenance? How many times do things go wrong just because we didn't scrub the hub?
Something for you to think about next time you see a nurse checking a line. They aren't just looking at a tube. They're fighting a physics battle. Thanks for listening to this deep dive.
Say cheers.
See you next time.